Time for a quick break to talk about McDonald's. Mornings are for mixing and matching at McDonald's. For just $3, mix and match two of your favorite breakfast items, including a sausage McMuffin, sausage biscuit, sausage burrito, and hash browns. Make it even better with a delicious medium iced coffee. With McDonald's mix and match, you can't go wrong. Price and participation may vary. Cannot be combined with any other offer or combo meal. Single item at regular price.
If it's Monday, Ukraine recaptures huge swaths of territory in a surprise offensive, sending Russian forces fleeing in what could be a major turning point in the war. Plus, former President Trump's legal team tries to show doubt about whether the documents seized from Mar-a-Lago really were classified, part of their latest effort to keep the FBI from going through those documents found at his Florida home. And amid the national battle over abortion bans, South Carolina Republican lawmakers tried and failed to enact a near total ban. I'll talk to one of the Republican lawmakers who broke ranks with his party on the issue ahead. Welcome to Meet the Press Now. I'm Kristen Welker. At any moment, President Biden is expected to deliver an update on his administration's goals to fight cancer, an effort dubbed the Moonshot Initiative. The president will deliver remarks from the JFK Library in Boston on the 60th anniversary of Kennedy's famous moonshot speech. We will have much more on the president's address coming up. But we do begin today with some really stunning developments out of Ukraine, as the nation's troops have recaptured large areas of occupied territory from Russia, breaking Putin's stranglehold in the northeast and in the south. Ukraine's top general says their armed forces have taken back more than 1,100 square miles since the beginning of September. And by one assessment, Ukraine has taken back more territory in 5 days than Russian forces have captured in all of their operations since April. While in Prague, Secretary of Defense Lloyd Austin acknowledged Ukraine's recent gains while pledging continued U.S. assistance.
We see success in Kherson now. We see some success in Kharkiv. And so that's very, very encouraging. I think they have great capability. They're using it the right way. And we'll stay engaged and make sure that we're giving them what they need to be successful.
This counteroffensive by Ukraine represents a potentially major blow to Putin and Russia's military 6 months into this war. The Kremlin is trying to control the narrative, with Russian state media saying what happened in Kharkiv was not a retreat, and the defense ministry dismissing reports that Russian troops are feeling very dissuaded by all of this. Meanwhile, in Zaporizhia, operators at Europe's largest nuclear facility currently being occupied by Russian troops have been able to restore the backup power line and have now shut down the last operating reactor. While speaking to reporters today, the UN's nuclear chief continued to show concerns about the stability of the plant, but also signaled that Russia and Ukraine may be interested in an IAEA proposal to set up a protection zone. That would be a significant development. Indeed. Joining me now to discuss all of these developments from Kyiv is NBC foreign correspondent Megan Fitzgerald. Also with me are NBC News Pentagon correspondent Courtney Kuby and former U.S. ambassador to Russia and NBC international affairs analyst Michael McFaul. Thanks to all of you so much for being here on a Monday. Megan, I do want to start with you to start us off. Ukraine has made these enormous gains over the weekend, but what is the reality check here? What are Ukrainian officials saying about this counteroffensive?
You know, Kristen, they are very excited and optimistic about what they're seeing, because keep in mind, they launched this counteroffensive just 2 weeks ago today. Since then, Ukrainian President Zelensky is saying that they've been able to take back, and of course, this number continues to climb. The latest number coming in is more than 1,300 square miles of territory. They launched this counteroffensive in the southern part of the country, in the Kherson region. That's the area where we saw the Russians quickly seize in the start of this invasion. They've been able to liberate some communities and towns down there, but all the way up to the Kherson region and or to Kharkiv region. And this is where we're seeing some of the most significant advancements, certainly within the last several days. The president's saying dozens and dozens of settlements there have been liberated. And we're also starting to see images coming in, video coming in from these soldiers on the ground, capturing those moments where these people who have been in Russian occupied territory for months are running to these soldiers, thanking them for this liberation, a moment that they had been waiting for, Kristen.
Really is just extraordinary. Megan, Russia's being pushed back on its heels, as you're pointing out, and it really comes as the reactor at Zaporizhzhia power plant is in Russian-controlled territory. It was shut down. Can you give us the latest on the safety of this power plant?
So, you know, Kristen, over the last several weeks, we've really watched this power plant sort of go into this downward spiral. Some optimistic news tonight, just within the last couple of hours, the IAEA is saying that they were able to restore the second offsite power line. So this is good news moving in the right direction, because we know over the weekend they were forced to shut down the sixth and only working reactor. And they were able to repair the first backup line. All of this is so critical because this is the way to power the plant. And the concern is that the shelling just continues. And if it knocks off these power lines that have now been restored to the plant, they would have to rely on these backup diesel generators. That's a concern because we know that there's only a 10-day supply of diesel. And once that runs out, that is why these inspectors are saying that there's concern for a nuclear meltdown, Kristen.
There has just been so much concern surrounding that power plant. Megan, thank you so much for staying up late with us. Continue to stay safe. We really appreciate your reporting. Courtney, I want to turn to you. What is your reality check here on what we are witnessing? These extraordinary gains that Ukraine was able to make over the weekend. Just how significant are the gains? Is it a turning point?
So gains are extraordinary. Absolutely, you're right about that. And it's significant for a number of reasons. But take a step back here and remember, this is a battle that Ukraine clearly is winning, but this is not the whole war. And if you look at the map of Ukraine, that tells it tells the picture of that. So the Ukrainian military, what's really significant here is they were able to go across Russian lines and hit at a bunch of their logistics locations. And that was one of the reasons that they were able to take this area around Kharkiv, a very key city called Izium. You see it on the map here. So where we see the blue on this map, that is where Ukraine was able to take back area from Russia. You see all along just around Kharkiv, a very critical city, and then Izium down just a little bit southeast of there. So it is a significant amount of territory. The Ukrainians are saying that they got back about 1,200 square miles of territory. For perspective here, Kristen, that's about what it maybe even a little bit more than what the Russians have taken throughout this entire conflict. Mm. So a significant amount. You can also see, if you look a little bit further south, the Ukrainians have opened lines of offense where we see the red and the white on that map in Donetsk and into a small area in Luhansk. That is also very significant as a multiple line of offensive here by the Ukrainian military. Another thing that's really significant about this current fight right now is we have heard cases where the Russians have been reaching out to others like the North Koreans for things like artillery. They are still struggling with their logistics here. Mm. Not just the logistics that we've seen from the very beginning, which was them struggling for fuel and food to support their soldiers, but they are really running short, according to reports that we've heard from both Ukrainian officials and U.S. officials. They're running short on things like ammunition. That's very significant here. Remember the time of year. We're going into a colder time of year there in Ukraine, and they are struggling for what has become a real artillery fight in this condensed area in the east and in the southeast. But as I mentioned, we're going into a colder time of year. That's a time where the Ukrainian military might start to struggle a little bit more, especially if the Russians are able to cut off some of their natural resources that may make it a more difficult fight. So going back to your original question, Kristen, this is Ukraine really winning this battle here, but there still is a larger war here that they will continue realistically to fight for some time in the future.
Well, it's just such an incredible breakdown of the nuances of everything that we were reporting on over the weekend. We know that the U.S. has announced $675 million in military aid. talk a little bit about how the U.S. is viewing all of this, Courtney, all of your sources if you've been talking to? And is there concern that the U.S. might not be able to sustain the level of aid that it's been providing to Ukraine?
So when you talk about the aid, the military equipment that the U.S. has been providing, specifically things like these artillery rounds, which, again, has been so critical. This has been an artillery battle that we've seen over these last several weeks, really throughout this summer, an artillery battle, in some cases in close quarters between the Ukrainians and the Russian military here. There's been a concern for months now about whether the U.S. providing equipment and ammunition from U.S. military stockpiles at some point, will that begin to degrade the U.S. military's readiness? Well, one thing that we've seen, one way that the U.S. has been able to counter that concern is by some of the additional aid that we just recently heard the U.S. was providing. It actually draws on private industry. And so it's not coming directly from U.S. military stockpiles. But what you just said here about this additional $675 million in aid, this has made the real difference. This U.S. equipment and ammunition and aid that they've been providing, but also that's come from the from around the world. That's why we are not seeing we are seeing the Ukrainian military really make advances and gains. It's what the world is providing them that's been allowed them to take on. And right here now, this is an offensive. This is not just the Ukrainian military on the defense. They are going against Russia in this offensive right now, Kristen. And it's because the world's been supporting them that they've been able to do it in many cases.
Well, incredible reporting and analysis. As always, Courtney, you have given me a lot to talk about with Ambassador McFaul. I really appreciate it. Ambassador, let me get you to just give us the big picture view, if you would. I asked Courtney, and I'm curious for your take. Do you think this could be a turning point for Ukraine, or is it just too soon to tell?
Well, if we're taking the really big viewpoint, 30,000 feet over the course of the war, I think it's important context to remember that every battle so far, not the war, but the battles, the Ukrainians are winning. Remember what Putin said he was doing when he invaded. He said he was going to unite Ukrainians and Russians because Ukrainians are just Russians with accents. He hasn't done that. He pledged to denazify Ukraine. That is overthrow the regime, President Zelensky. He didn't do that. Then he tried to take the capital of Kiev, if you remember that several months ago. He failed at that. And this now, I think, is the next big failure, that they have failed to hold on to territory that they captured months ago in the region of Kharkiv. Kharkiv, so you know, is the second largest city in Ukraine. A lot of the region of Kharkiv had been occupied by the Russians, and now they're pushing it back. So, you know, there have had some victories down in the south around Kherson. Of course, the Russians have taken. But this, I think, marks another major victory for the Ukrainians. I don't know what the future will bring, but today this is a huge victory for Ukraine.
Ambassador McFaul, I keep going back to the beginning. U.S. officials were telling me this is going to last 48 hours. Here we are 6 months into this. And Ukraine is gaining ground in these key areas. It really seems extraordinary for all the reasons that you just mapped out. Add to that Courtney's reporting, the fact that there are still morale issues within the Russian troops, the fact that there are still strategic problems that Russia continues to deal with. What do you make of that? The fact that that has been an ongoing issue for the Russian army, what was supposed to come in and within 48 hours overtake Ukraine, now 6 months into this?
Well, a couple of things. We were wrong about the Ukrainian army. Let's just be blunt about it. We were right that Putin was going to invade. That was a major intelligence achievement, and that they declassified that. Fantastic. We were wrong about the Ukrainian capabilities to fight. And therefore, we should be very careful when we watch this counteroffensive right now, surprising everyone, to suggest that they're not going to be successful down in Kherson. That's where the next fight, that's the place to watch, what they do in Kherson. Number two, our supplies of equipment have mattered. The long fires that you were just talking about, the HIMARS, is now giving them the capability to soften up those Russian forces. And then third, to go on the offensive, where the will to fight is what really matters. I've been watching tons of videos from Russians, Ukrainians in and around Kharkiv. And what you see is determined Ukrainian soldiers, by the way, being greeted by Ukrainians that want to be liberated. So this myth that these people want wanted to be taken in by Russia, we now see. And you see these videos from scared Russians that are running for their life because they don't know why they're there to fight. They don't know what this war is about. And that momentum, that moral side, that helps Ukrainians when the fight is really close.
Ambassador McFaul, looming over all of this has always been this big question. Can this end with Putin still in power? I want to read you what Anne Applebaum wrote in The Atlantic this weekend and get your reaction on the other side. She wrote, "We must expect that a Ukrainian victory and certainly a victory in Ukraine's understanding of the term also brings about the end of Putin's regime. To be clear, this is not a prediction. It's a warning. Many things about the current Russian political system are strange, and one of the strangest is the total absence of a mechanism for succession." What do you make of that? And what is the warning within that, Ambassador?
Well, I've always believed that this war was the end of Putinism. He overreached, right? It's like Brezhnev in Afghanistan. He won a string of victories, small wars that he won, and he overreached in Ukraine. I'm not going to try to predict, just like Anne didn't, when that happens. But I think it's inconceivable that Putinism, the system of government in place under Vladimir Putin, will be in place 5 or 10 years from now. What you're already seeing, which is also an incredible event over the weekend, you're now seeing in public, even on Russian state-controlled television stations, a debate about who's at fault for this war. That was not happening just 4 days ago, and you're beginning to see people pointing the fingers. Is it the generals? Is it the intelligence officers? They're turning on each other, and I predict that if Ukraine continues to march forward, that debate will become louder and louder.
That in and of itself is incredibly significant, potentially signaling a real blow to the Putin campaign for information. Thank you so much, Ambassador McFaul. Really appreciate all of your incredible analysis. And before that, Megan Fitzgerald and Courtney Kuby. Coming up, primary season finale. Voters gear up to hit the polls as the Trump wing of the Republican Party is tested one more time at the ballot box. We're live in Battleground, New Hampshire next. You're watching Meet the Press now.
Spectrum One is a big deal. You get Spectrum Internet with the most reliable internet speeds, free advanced Wi-Fi for enhanced security and privacy, and a free Spectrum Mobile Unlimited line with nationwide 5G included, all while saving big. For the big speed, big reliability, and big savings you want, get Spectrum One. Just $49.99 a month for 12 months. Visit spectrum.com/bigdeal for full details. Offer subject to change. Valid for qualified residential customers only. Service not available in all areas. Restrictions apply.
Time for a quick break to talk about McDonald's. Mornings are for mixing and matching at McDonald's. For just $3, mix and match two of your favorite breakfast items, including a sausage McMuffin, sausage biscuit, sausage burrito, and hash browns. Make it even better with a delicious medium iced coffee. With McDonald's mix and match, you can't go wrong. Price and participation may vary. Cannot be combined with any other offer or combo meal. Single item at regular price.
Welcome back. Turning to politics now, where months of bitterly contested primary battles between establishment Republicans and Trump Republicans are finally coming to an end. Voters in New Hampshire head to the polls tomorrow, and Republicans will pick their nominee to take on Democratic Senator Maggie Hassan. This is one of the races we are watching very closely that could decide control of the Senate in November. The top two contenders in the Republican primary are State Senator Chuck Morse and retired Brigadier General Don Bolduc. Former President Donald Trump has not yet made an endorsement in this race, but Bolduc is clearly the Trumpier candidate, having backed Mr. Trump's false claims about the 2020 election and echoed his attacks on the FBI. The state's more mainstream Republican governor, Chris Sununu, made a last-minute endorsement for Bolduc's rival, Morse, on Friday. And national Republicans really wanted Sununu to run himself, of course. And despite being an outspoken 2020 election denier, Bolduc has also gotten a boost from national Democrats, who are once again spending millions of dollars in a Republican primary, hoping to get the more extreme candidate on November's ballot. We have seen this throughout the primaries. NBC's Dasha Burns is on the ground for us in Londonderry, New Hampshire. So, Dasha, let's set the stakes here. What are you watching in the final hours of this race?
Well, Kristen, you laid it out beautifully there. As the primary season comes to a close, we're seeing sort of the culmination of the trends that we've seen throughout this primary season, a divided Republican Party, Democratic meddling in Republican primaries. And here we have a vulnerable Democratic incumbent in Senator Maggie Hassan. This is a seat that Republicans are really hoping to flip. They want to be competitive here, but there's a challenge in candidate quality where we're looking at an establishment Republican who's been backed, you mentioned, by the Republican governor, by a lot of the Republican fundraising arms. Basically, the mainstream Republican Party is behind State Senator Chuck Morse. But it seems that the Republican base and the voters, especially those that we've been talking to today, are really lining up behind Don Bolduc, retired brigadier general. He has been leading in the polls significantly. But as you mentioned there, he is very much a farther right candidate, much farther than right than Chuck Morse. He's supported the former president's claims of a stolen election. He's a hardline conservative in his policies and his values. But he's been doing the ground game here, really grassroots campaigning across all of the counties, whereas Chuck Morse, his rival, has really been playing the game on the airwaves. I asked Don Bolduc earlier today how he feels watching his party, the establishment, really line up behind his opponent. Take a listen to what he told me. What do you make of the fact that so many of those sort of more traditional Republicans have lined up behind your opponent?
That we're winning. That we're a threat to the establishment,
yeah.
That we're a threat to the status quo, that we're a threat to the existence of what they put in place at the expense of Granite Staters and the people of this country.
So more a badge of honor than an offense.
It is a badge of honor, and I carry it with me.
Kristen, of course, we've seen it time again, campaigning in the primary, very different than campaigning in the general. And here in New Hampshire, especially, you've got about 30% of voters as registered Republicans. You've got about 38% unaffiliated. And so Democrats, the reason you're seeing that Democratic meddling here, they're hoping to sink Chuck Morse. They're hoping that Don Bolduc will be the candidate running against Democrat Maggie Hassan. They think she'll have a much better chance with a more extreme, a farther right, more conservative candidate in the general election. Kristen?
Dasha, you always get the candidates. It's so impressive. Very quickly, in talking to Republicans, how is there real disappointment that Kristen Unu didn't get into the race, especially given what they're seeing now?
Well, it depends which Republicans you talk to, right? We had a group of folks here at this local business today, many of whom had never been involved in politics before, hadn't ever shown up to candidate events like this, but did show up for Don Bolduc. So he's got kind of the Trump factor, if you will. We're using that term these days to engage voters that haven't been previously. But I'd say a lot of the sort of core Republican voters, listen, Sununu's very popular in the state. A lot of folks were hoping for him to run. But the primary system is the primary system, and the way we've been going lately, it seems that the primary system these days is more advantageous for some of the harder line candidates than the traditional Republicans, Kristen.
Yeah, I think you're absolutely right. Well, it is a process that is almost over. Dasha, thank you so much. I'm going to break all of that down now with my great panel. Joining me on set is Tia Mitchell, Washington correspondent for the Atlanta Journal-Constitution, Democratic strategist and former president of Emily's List, Stephanie Schrock, and Republican strategist and former RNC communications director Doug High. Thanks so much to all of you for being here. So, Tia, let's just talk about New Hampshire. The stage will be set, essentially, for the battle for the Senate. Based on who you're talking to, who's feeling more confident about holding on to the Senate, winning the Senate back potentially in November?
Well, we know that recently even Senator McConnell has, you know, cast some doubt on Republicans' efforts to retake control of the Senate. It's evenly split right now. Democrats are hoping actually to pick up seats. And that's why this New Hampshire race is so important, because you do have an incumbent. Democrats can't afford to lose any of their 50. They want to add on to it. And so they have made the calculation that Senator Hassan will have an easier chance if the Trumpier candidate is on the ballot in November.
Yeah, I want to delve into that strategy. But Doug, first, here you have yet another state, New Hampshire, one in a list of them, Arizona, to name another, where you basically have the governor who's opted out of running for Senate. Do you think there's a wistfulness within the Republican Party and a sense of regret that these are missed opportunities, that they're tougher to win now?
You know, in Washington, sure. If you're the senatorial committee, the congressional committee, the Republican Governors Association, you want whoever that top candidate is. You know, it's like signing the free agent on pick your sport. You want the best player you can possibly get. But the reality is, let's say Chris Sununu won. One, he'd have to go through the Republican primary process of 2022. That's not a lot of fun. And then if he wins, he doesn't get to. He has to work at that building across the street. Mm. And there are 100 people who are working there right now who are miserable. And I'm talking about the ones who are elected. I talked to one 2 weeks ago who's retiring, who said, I can't wait to leave here. Mm. That's what's happening in Washington, D.C. right now. So I wouldn't wish victory on anybody to go into the Senate right now.
Says so much about the climate right now. Tia, you mentioned the fact that there has been this ongoing strategy among Democrats to prop up these conservative candidates, ultra-MAGA candidates, some would characterize them as. Chuck asked the vice president about this over the weekend. Let's take a watch at that exchange.
Is the Democratic Party making a mistake here by, you know, those people could win if you're not careful?
I mean, listen, I'm not going to tell people how to run their campaigns. You know, I ran in terms of statewide office.
Would you have Would you have done this? Is this in your? Is this something you'd be comfortable
with? I'm not going to tell people how to run their campaigns, Chuck. I'm not going to tell people what
you're
to
not
do
worried
that
this reflects poorly on the Democrats.
I think that what we have to focus on is that in 60 days, as of this interview, in less than 2 months, we are looking at a midterm election in which so much is on the line.
Stephanie, what was your reaction to seeing that exchange, her response?
Well, I think she's exactly right. There's no reason for the vice president of the United States to comment on how anybody runs their campaigns. So I think that is exactly precisely what she should be saying. But I want to talk a little bit about this particular situation in New Hampshire, because I think it's important to recognize that every race has its own reasons and vibes and why people get engaged. Let us not forget that the National Republicans have already put $4 million behind Morris. They've already chosen their candidate. They are pushing a lot of money into a primary, which we got to focus on that, on all positive things about Morris. Mm. So then you've got the Senate saying, well, if this guy does win, we've got to not let that stand. And it's a short timeline, right? Because we got the latest primary. Thank you, New Hampshire. Just wait till the very end to get this done. But this is a short turnaround timeline. But so I think it's actually smart to go up.
Is it playing with fire, though, this strategy? Is it morally defensible?
I would say, particularly in New Hampshire, you got a situation where this guy would be the general election candidate, and the general election's already started that way. If he's not the general election candidate, we're up against a Trump candidate.
Here's why it's a problem. And it's regardless of win or lose. If you believe that this is conspiracy theory denying elections, if you think it's anti-gay, if you think it's anti-minority, anti-woman, then by giving these candidates a basis to run on, win or lose, you're creating that atmosphere that you're calling hate. And so whether it's in Doug Mastriano in Pennsylvania, whether it's the Republican candidate Dan Cox in Maryland, who's going to lose, you're giving a platform for that hate. And so then if they do win, it's not playing with matches. It's political arson.
But I think it's important, though, because, yes, Democrats have spent money attacking Morse, who could be the Republican nominee. But they've also spent money kind of amplifying Bolduc. And in those ads paid for by the Democrats, though, they're saying, here's exactly who this guy is. He's an election denier. He's Trumpy. And they're amplifying the truth about him, but they know that's something that could resonate in the primary.
The number two elected Democrat should be able to say that. Joe Biden certainly doesn't have a problem saying about Republicans.
But there is nothing being said in these ads that isn't true and is going to be said about these candidates in the general election, because this is who these folks are.
I want to talk about this issue of election deniers. The vice president was asked about this by Chuck as well. I'm going to play that clip and then we'll discuss that as well.
Nearly 70% of Republicans don't believe that the president and yourself won the 2020 election legitimately. Do you think you'll ever be able to change their minds?
I find that polling interesting, and I'm going to tell you why. I'm traveling the country. We're here in Houston. I was in, North Carolina. I've been traveling all over the country. I don't find that.
You say you take issue with this idea that there are 70%. Do you think
there's really... I just don't experience that.
Tia, what does that mean she doesn't experience that? Does that potentially run the risk of making her look out of touch, given that that is the reality?
I think it does. And I think it might be true. I mean, people may be a little bit more polite when they meet the vice president in person and not say, hey, we don't think you're the legitimate winner of the office you now hold. But I also wonder if it's just her not wanting to amplify those people who, you know, would try to, you know, downplay her position or delegitimize her position. That's what I took it as, her not wanting to give air to that.
I completely agree with you. Absolutely. It's like... they don't want to be talking about this. It keeps on coming up. They know why amplify it, particularly as the vice president of the United States.
But the reality is they are amplifying it at the DCCC, at the DSCC, at the DGA. And these Republican candidates who feel this way, quite often they don't have the money to spend themselves. And so what they're getting is a real free infusion of cash that they couldn't raise on their own, courtesy of Democrats. And it's troubling.
Talking about things that have been amplified, let's talk about the issue of inflation. Doug, you have in recent days some Republicans saying this is not going to cut it as a campaign message. Mm-hmm. It's not going to be tough enough to win some of these very close races, in part because you're starting to see the numbers tick down. You're starting to see gas prices come down a little bit. What do you make of that argument? And do you think inflation should still be the centerpiece of these campaigns?
It should be. One, Republicans haven't been making this message often enough and strong enough. And frankly, every time Donald Trump opens his mouth, every Republican has to respond to that. And so they're not talking about these issues. Two, it's also still the number one issue for Republicans and the number one issue for Democrats. Is it at that kind of, you know, touchstone place that it was in July or June? No, but it's still number one. So they should be talking about this. And look at all those things that have 70% of the country saying that we're moving in the wrong direction, and focus on that and only that.
Though, Doug, it may be number one, but it's barely number one. There's such a suite of issues.
Okay, but it's not climate change. It's not, what is it?
But it's also not, but abortion is rapidly going up, and now you've got Republicans all over the country scrubbing their websites and running ads, changing their views all the
time. Any team winning the NCAA would want to be barely the champion. If you win by 1 point, you win. That's politics.
Let me read what former Trump advisor Stephen Moore told the Washington Post. He said, this is one of the things I'm telling Republicans. Yes, inflation is high, but it's coming down. Inflation is not going to be like it was in March and April with huge increases. And I think broadening the message is going to be necessary. Tia, are you talking to Republicans who are starting to broaden their message? Are you seeing this play out?
I think Republicans are trying, but right now, a lot of Republicans are still in primary mode for better or for worse. Mm-hmm. And they're going to have to figure out how to pivot to create that more universal message. Because again, Donald Trump, for better or for worse, is still a big part of the conversation. Election denialism is still a big part of the conversation from Republican elected officials and Republicans on the ballot. That's not necessarily going to be a winning message in the general election for a lot of, you know, contested races, for these statewide races and these Senate races. But how will they broaden it? Yes, election, the economy, inflation, health care, and then climate change and abortion. They are what voters care about.
Crime is rising.
Crime as well.
Well, and that speaks to the idea of broadening the message, that at least some Republicans feel like it has to go beyond inflation and the numbers. All right. Thank you so much. This was a great conversation. Tia, Stephanie, and Doug, really appreciate it. And coming up next, former President Trump's lawyers are telling a judge today that the Justice Department's investigation has, quote, spiraled out of control. We'll explain. You're watching Meet the Press now. Stay with us.
I think that... our country is a country that has gone through different periods of time where the unthinkable has happened, and where there has been a call for justice, and justice has been served. And I think that's potentially going to always be the case in our country, that people are going to demand justice, and they rightly do.
Welcome back. That was Vice President Harris in her exclusive interview with Chuck, responding to whether it would be too divisive to prosecute a former president. That interview came before Mr. Trump's lawyers today asked a federal judge to continue blocking the DOJ from reviewing documents marked classified that were seized during the FBI's search of Mar-a-Lago last month. In a court filing today, the former president's lawyers called the investigation, quote, unprecedented and misguided. The filing is in response to the Justice Department's intent to appeal the judge's decision to appoint a special master to review the documents. For more, I'm joined by NBC News Justice and Intelligence Correspondent Ken Delanian and Carol Lamb, a former federal prosecutor who's now an NBC News legal analyst. Thanks so much to both of you for being here. Ken, let me start with you. What are the top lines of this filing? What are you watching?
And Kristen, what's interesting about it is it's not just about the special master. It gives us an insight into what Donald Trump's possible defenses would be. And what it is, essentially, is his lawyers are portraying this as a document dispute that got out of control. What they're saying is this is simply a matter of the president and the archives, the National Archives, negotiating about presidential records, which, of course, contain some sensitive information. And by the way, they call it allegedly classified documents. They're not acknowledging that the documents are classified. They're saying the government has to prove that. They're saying this never should have been a criminal investigation. What this ignores, though, is that some of these records, as described, are not presidential records. They're CIA records, potentially, or National Security Agency records. They're records of other government agencies. They did not belong to Donald Trump. And this also leaves completely aside the national security concerns. Trump's lawyers are arguing those are overblown. Obviously, the DOJ disagrees.
And they're not going so far as to say that former President Trump declassified those documents, correct?
They are not indeed, because there's no evidence that he did. And to make that representation in court, they'd have to back it up some way. And it doesn't appear that they can do that. But they could raise that question at a trial and require the prosecution to prove that they were properly classified.
Carol, I want to ask you about part of what Ken just laid out, which is the argument that's being made by the Trump legal team that these documents do not belong to the Justice Department. Let me read you a little bit of the filing and get your reaction on the other side. It says, quote, what is clear regarding all of the seized materials is that they belong with either President Trump as his personal property to be returned pursuant to Rule 41G or with NARA, but not with the Department of Justice. What do you make of this? And doesn't the fact that NARA is a part of the executive branch undermine that argument potentially?
And Kristen, there's so many confusing arguments in that pleading this morning that I'll be honest, I had a little trouble pulling the threads apart. I think one of the most unusual arguments I saw them make was that the Justice Department had to prove to the special master that these were indeed classified documents. That is such a strange argument, because let's go back a little bit and let's remember what the purpose of the special master is. The purpose of the special master is to evaluate whether the Justice Department can look at certain documents that might be privileged, either attorney-client privileged or the Trump team says executive privilege. Now, the Justice Department disagrees with the executive privilege review. But let's put that aside, because they're not threatening to appeal that at this point. They're just saying, hey, these documents that say classified on them, these documents that actually say classified on them, they're not personal documents. They are not documents that are communications between the president and his lawyers, and they are not communications between the president and his staff. So there is no reason for a special master to look at those documents, and we need them to continue our criminal investigation. In fact, they say these are the criminal violation that we are investigating. So the Trump team has tried to turn this very strange little procedural thing of a special master on its head, and they have tried to now they're trying to have the trial right now at the beginning or the middle of this investigation. It's a very, very strange situation. I'm sure the Justice Department is scratching its head saying, how did we end up here?
So, Carol, given that, what are you watching for next? And if a special master is, in fact, appointed, how does that process unfold? You're saying the special master wouldn't necessarily determine the classification status of these documents.
A special master definitely should not be determining the classification status of the documents. That is maybe a technical defense that the president might bring up at trial or post-indictment. There hasn't been an indictment here, and we don't know if there will be one. What I'll be looking for next is, at now that she's gotten both sides' views about her order, will the judge revisit her order and do what the Justice Department asks? The Justice Department has asked for a very, very narrow set of relief here. All the Justice Department asks is that she lift her injunction saying that you can't investigate, you can't use these documents to investigate. would she lift that portion that applies to just the documents that say classified on them? All the other stuff, all those other documents, the Justice Department is saying, fine, you want to have a special master look at them, go ahead. It's just that narrow set of maybe 130 documents, which, in my view, she incorrectly said could not be used for this period of time until the special master has an opportunity to look at them.
Ken, let me ask you about some developments surrounding this broader court battle. We know that the Justice Department has charged a woman with threatening Judge Cannon, the judge presiding over all of this. What can you tell us about that? And it's just incredibly disturbing.
It is, Kristen. According to the criminal complaint, this woman made some vile and disgusting threats over voicemail and email directed at the judge, was arrested, has been charged. But it's also true that, according to the complaint, she has a history of mental instability and was interviewed by the Secret Service for making death threats against Donald Trump. So in this case, it seems like a mentally disturbed individual. But it underscores how volatile this whole situation is right now. And people who are on the edge are pushed over the edge by some of the rhetoric that's rocketing around our politics.
Yeah, really smart way to put that. Ken Delaney, and thank you so much. And Carol Lamb, really appreciate your both joining me today. After the break, goodbyes and new beginnings for Britain as King Charles III leads his late mother's coffin to lie at rest in public for the first time. We'll have details on the Queen's services and the future of the monarchy. That's next. You're watching Meet the Press now. Welcome back. Right now, mourners in Scotland are paying their respects to Queen Elizabeth II. The Queen is lying in rest right now inside St. Giles Cathedral in Edinburgh. Her coffin arrived there earlier today after a process through the Scottish capital. At the cathedral, the Queen was honored during a service of thanksgiving. Among those in attendance at that service, the new British Prime Minister Liz Truss, whom the Queen appointed less than a week ago. Afterward, King Charles III heard messages of condolences from the Scottish Parliament before sharing a message of his own with Scottish lawmakers.
If I might paraphrase the words of the great Robert Burns, my dear mother was the friend of man, the friend of truth, the friend of age, and guide of youth. Few hearts like hers with virtue warmed, few heads with knowledge so informed.
King Charles and other members of the royal family then traveled back to the cathedral where they held a vigil by the Queen's coffin. Tomorrow, the coffin will travel by train back to London, where thousands of mourners will pay their respects on Wednesday. King Charles, meanwhile, will travel to Northern Ireland for a service in Belfast. Turning now to Boston and news in this country, where President Biden is speaking at the Kennedy Presidential Library, announcing next steps in his Cancer Moonshot Initiative. The speech comes exactly 60 years after JFK's moonshot speech, which announced his goal of putting a man on the moon, a goal the country could unite behind. Moments ago, the president painted this program as a potentially unifying effort as well. Take a listen.
This Cancer Moonshot is one of the reasons why I ran for president. It's part of my unity agenda that I laid out in my State of the Union address to rally the American people to work together. Because we know this, cancer does not discriminate red and blue. It doesn't care if you're a Republican or a Democrat. Beating cancer is something we can do together. And that's why I'm here today.
President Biden is also expected to announce a longtime science advisor will head up a new agency aimed at health research. It's an issue that is deeply personal for so many Americans, including the president, who lost his son, Beau, to brain cancer in 2015. Still to come, divisions in the GOP over abortion access come to a head in South Carolina. I will talk to a Republican lawmaker who was a key part of stopping a near total ban in his state and what it means for his party's post-Roe strategy. You're watching Meet the Press now. Stay with us. Welcome back. A group of South Carolina Republican lawmakers barred a near total abortion ban from passing the state Senate last Thursday, taking a stand against other members of their own party. Even without the group, Republicans in the state Senate still had the votes needed to pass the ban, but they did not have the support necessary to vote down a filibuster threatened by Republican state Senator Tom Davis. Davis said the bill failed to balance women's bodily autonomy and the rights of the fetus and promised his daughters he would take that action. Listen to what he said.
I have a 28-year-old daughter, a 22-year-old daughter, and a 17-year-old daughter. And they'd say to me with one voice, Dad, you aren't going to let this happen, are you? You're not going to let this happen. You guys aren't going to, up in Columbia, tell us that from the moment that we become pregnant, we lose all control over what happens inside our body. You're not really going to do that, are you, Dad? And my response to them is, I'm not.
Divisions on the issue of abortion have become pronounced within the Republican Party in recent weeks. Some Republicans feel the hardline restrictive stance the party has taken is out of touch with voters' reactions to this summer's Supreme Court ruling, softening their message before the midterms. I am joined now by Republican State Senator from South Carolina, Tom Davis. State Senator Davis, thanks so much for joining me. I really appreciate it. I know you're busy. You're in your car right now, heading from one place to the next, so I appreciate your stopping to talk to us.
Happy to be with you.
Let's pick up on that impassioned speech that you delivered, if we can. You said you promised your daughters you would not vote for that near total ban. Can you walk me through what the decision-making process was like for you?
I mean, absolutely. I mean, when you think about the bill that was before us, it would have banned abortions from the time of conception. So essentially what you're saying is, you know, once a sperm fertilizes an egg, a woman loses all autonomy over her body altogether. I just do not believe that is a reasonable balancing of the rights that are involved here. And there are more than just one right involved. It's not just the right of the unborn child to be born. There's also the right of the woman to autonomy over her body. So you have two rights, each deserving of respect. They obviously conflict with each other. And so what I think our job is as a legislature was to balance those competing rights, to look at that right of a woman to autonomy of her body and balance it against the right of the unborn child to be born. And for me, I think there ought to be deference paid to the woman at the beginning of the pregnancy. And then as you move along the term throughout the 9 months, I mean, gradually, I think that right yields to the right of the unborn child to be born. But I just cannot subscribe to this notion that once the sperm fertilizes an egg, that a woman loses all control over her body. I don't think that's a reasonable balancing of the respective rights.
Well, you were joined by four other Republican lawmakers. Three of them were women who voted against this ban. But as you have said, I mean, there is a divide within your party. There was a divide within your own state legislature. How consequential do you think this divide is?
Well, I think we're going through some soul searching right now in the Republican Party. It's the first time we've had this debate in regard to a woman's right to an abortion and the right of an unborn child to come to term and be born in the post-Roe world. I mean, the debates we've had in the past were more or less academic debates, because irrespective of what we passed, if it was violative of the Supreme Court's ruling in Roe v. Wade as modified by the Casey decision, it was going to be enjoined by the federal court. And so, in essence, it was an academic exercise. But last June, when the United States Supreme Court reversed Roe, when it reversed Casey, and it said this is a matter for the legislature to decide, I think you have a lot of people looking at this with new eyes, looking at this with a degree of criticalness that they haven't in the past. Mm. And so right now, I think we're sorting through this issue.
Well, it's notable to hear you frame it in that context. And I guess politically, we have seen the impact already in some places. In Kansas, for example, when abortion was quite literally on the ballot in that special election, in New York as well. State Senator Davis, do you think the issue of abortion could cost Republicans the chance to win back the House or the Senate?
Well, it certainly has made the issue more salient and more relevant. I mean, right now we're dealing in an environment that, quite frankly, most people considered the issue of abortion to be settled by Roe v. Wade. We've had 49 years worth of federal jurisprudence establishing a woman's right to an abortion.
But just to put a fine point on it, State Senator, just to put a fine point on it, do you think it's going to hurt Republicans in the midterms?
I don't know if it'll hurt them, but I think it brings the issue to bear. I think voters are going to be wanting to hear answers, and I think individuals better be prepared to make arguments.
Do you think, though, given what I guess the way to frame it is, what do you think the impact is when you see the turnout and the results in a Kansas or in that New York special election? And what is your message to fellow Republicans who are running in these really close races?
I will say this, that if you're going to support a ban on abortion from the moment of conception, if you're going to take away all autonomy of a woman to write over her body when a sperm fertilizes the egg, there's going to be political consequences if you take that extreme position. I don't think there's any question about that.
And, you know, it's notable because as you were walking through how you came to this conclusion, you talked about the fact that as the pregnancy goes on, it is your belief that ultimately you then have to take the rights of the fetus into greater consideration. And I wonder where you think that line stands. Right now, obviously, it's a bit murky in your state. What will happen in the long term? Right now, I believe the current law stops abortion access at 20 weeks, but there is an effort underway to stop it at 6 weeks, to impose a 6-week trigger ban. Where do you stand? Would you support that 6-week ban?
Yeah, right now, I have voted for a bill that has a ban when a fetal heartbeat can be detected, which is typically at about 6 months. With exceptions for rape and incest, for the life and health of the mother, and in cases where a physician has diagnosed the baby with a fatal fetal anomaly. So that's the status of the law right now in South Carolina. Quite frankly, I think people who are at the extremes on either perspective are going to lose out. On the right, that means you can't take away a woman's right to autonomy when the sperm fertilizes the egg. But on the left, by the same token, you can't say that a woman's right to autonomy over her body extends through that entire 9-month term. I think that is equally a position that people reject. So I think the decision, or I think most people, most South Carolinians are somewhere in the middle.
It's such a fascinating perspective, and we really appreciate your joining us. South Carolina State Senator Tom Davis, thank you so much. And thank you for being with us this hour. I will be back tomorrow with more Meet the Press Now. NBC News Now coverage continues with my friend Hallie Jackson right now.
Time for a quick break to talk about McDonald's. Mornings are for mixing and matching at McDonald's. For just $3, mix and match two of your favorite breakfast items, including a sausage McMuffin, sausage biscuit, sausage burrito, and hash browns. Make it even better with a delicious medium iced coffee. With McDonald's mix and match, you can't go wrong. Price and participation may vary. Cannot be combined with any other offer or combo meal. Single item at regular price.